right. I almost messed up that one. Loose Wig 5, Side 3.
I'm going to tell you the true story of the three bears. Once upon a time, there were three bears. The mama bear, the papa bear, and the little self-absorbed piece of shit baby bear, who everyone in the whole bear community hated. So the bears were sitting in their bear house with nothing to do because they didn't have MTV. And the bears decide to eat something. So the papa bear is sitting and the papa bear say, "My shit is too hot." And the mama bear say, "My shit is too cold." And the baby bear say, "Somebody ate my shit all up." And the papa bear says, "Look, we never put shit down for you in the first place, you little piece of shit, you." So the bears decide to go to sleep, because that's what bears do. They eat and they sleep. And they shit in the woods. So the bears were sleeping, and the papa bear said, "My bed is too hard." And the mama bear said, "My bed is too soft." And the baby bear says, "Somebody slept in my bed and broke the shit out of it." And the papa bear says, "Look, we never wanted to have you in the first place. Why don't you pack up your little bear clothes and hit the road?" So the bear say, "We can't eat, we can't sleep. Let's go for a walk in the woods, because that's where bears go, to the woods." So the bears are walking in the woods, and they're walking and walking and walking. And all of a sudden, the papa bear stops and says, "Shit, I'm walking too fast." And the mama bear says, "I'm walking too slow." And the papa bear says, "Well, who the fuck am I talking to then?" So the bears go to the national park, and the tourists, the Japanese tourists, with about 300,000 fucking Minolta cameras, come up to the bears and say, "Bears, can we take your picture?" And the papa bear say, "You can take my picture." And the mama bear say, "You can take my picture." And the baby bear say, "You can take my picture." And the tourist says, "You know, we really only need two bears for this picture. Maybe we could lose that little piece of shit bear over there." So they take this incredible photo session, then they go back in the woods, and they're doing all kinds of cute little frisky bear shit. They're throwing little fruits and vegetables up in the air and catching them with their little bear faces and singing little bear songs in German. And all of a sudden, the papa bear turns around and he can't find the baby bear. And he can't believe it, because he's been trying to get rid of this piece of shit bear since before he decided to have this bear. So he has an incredible celebration in the woods. He calls up all the major movie studios to send over all their animated animals. And they send it over Bambi, and she got drunk and ran through the woods screaming fire, pissing everybody off. And the three little pigs, those little vile pieces of shit, were there. And the Flintstones and the Jetsons. And the three blind mice were there. They got drunk and puked and bumped into shit all night long. And they all go back to the three bears' house about 6 o'clock in the morning, completely fucking drunk. And guess who's waiting for them? Clint Eastwood. You haven't heard the story. The most important thing in all of life is love. Don't forget that. And Stephen Stills, the great songwriter, once said, "If you can't be with the one you love, then find some stranger and fuck that person." Thank you.
cruel only to be kind. Thus bad begins, and worse remains behind.
It's a beautiful message. It's a message of freedom and hope. A free society and a free market provides the greatest amount of wealth in the fairest distribution. If anybody is concerned about their fellow man, they really have to be a libertarian. Because if you care about poverty and the poor people and the ripping off of the system by the wealthy and the military-industrial complex, they have to be libertarians. Libertarianism will take care of the people, provide the prosperity and the peace that we all want.
We'd like to make it so that we understand what the role of government ought to be. This is what's generally happened in the 20th century, that we as a people have lost our way. We have accepted some ideas about what the government should be doing and what the concept of freedom is all about, to the point now where we have carelessly accepted the role of government as being an intervener, one that plans the economy, tells us what we should do with our private lives, and also accepting blindly our role as interferer or intervener in the internal affairs of other nations. We think that's wrong, and we should be going in another direction. The real challenge is big government versus individual liberty. Should the government be there as a planner, or should the government be there for the protection of liberty? Well, that answer was clearly defined by the founders of the country. Our founders, our forefathers, decided the British were too expressed too much control on us, and they said, we want less government. There was a Declaration of Independence, a Constitution, a war, and we had guidelines for limited government. Today, those guidelines are no longer looked at. One of the weakest arguments that can be used in the U.S. Congress is a constitutional argument. It isn't interesting to the other members of Congress. Big government versus individual liberty is the question that we must ask. What should the role of government be? Now, there's a reason that government has gotten out of control. It's a political reason more than an economic reason. The political reason is that we have allowed ourselves to accept the notion that government is to take care of special interests. We are a materialistic, obsessed society that says that government is in the business of redistributing wealth. And therefore, the pressure on the congressman is to get things and privileges for special groups. Now, what happens? Is he rewarded? Certainly is. They devise a monetary system that accommodates the politician. If they can't collect enough revenues from us, what they do is they devise a system where they can sell the debt to the Federal Reserve System. Now, where does the Federal Reserve get the money and credit so the Treasury can send out their checks? They get it out of thin air. It's positively amazing. They talk about us as libertarians having extreme ideas, but isn't it rather extreme and bizarre to think a government should run up a $220 billion deficit per year and then print the money to make up the difference? That to me is bizarre and something that we ought to challenge, and that's what we're doing. The money supply is important to us in Austrian economics and libertarianism is because Austrian economics teaches that the business cycle is explainable. For that reason, we as libertarians advocate a different monetary system, one where it is not centrally controlled by a monopoly, but one that comes from the marketplace, one that was designed by the founders of this country who had gone through inflation and that said that Congress should be very limited in monetary policy, and that is to the minting of gold and silver coins, but not to the artificial creation of credit out of thin air. Now, there are others than with our economic and political system. What holds it together? It's confidence. But is it good confidence? Are we putting our head in the sand? Are we accepting this because we truly have a sound monetary economic system? This is one thing that Ronald Reagan deserves credit for. He gives us a lot of confidence. He makes us feel good about ourselves. But is that good? I mean, what if I have a patient who has appendicitis and I hypnotize them and I make them feel good, then they die the next day of a ruptured appendix? I think we have to be willing to look at the hard, cold facts about what's happening and do something about it. And right now, it's out of control. And when you hear people like Felix Rohatyn mentioning how serious it is, I think we all ought to wake up. And the solution is political. The solution is political is that we need more determination in Washington to do a better job, to vote for less government. People need to be less materialistic and say the purpose of government is to give me things. The purpose of government is to give and protect and guarantee our liberty. The solution is to redefine the purpose of government. If we do not ask that question and we do not give the proper answer, it doesn't matter what you do. You can vote Dukakis, you can vote Bush, you can stay at home, it won't matter. Because the momentum is so great for getting the expansion of power in Washington. Just look at what they do in the name of the drug laws. Just look at what they do in the name of taking care of the poor. Just look at what they do in the name of spreading democracy around the world. It's totally out of control. Let's suggest that government ought to be limited for the purpose of guaranteeing liberty. The market ought to be free. We certainly object strenuously to the harassment of the Internal Revenue Service. The founders of this country were very upset about the taxing authorities of and the methods of the British. And yet today, what do? We complacently accept the role of slave by keeping all the records, allowing the records to be used to incriminate us. We assume that we're guilty until we prove our innocence to the Internal Revenue Service, and if we don't do that quickly, our property is confiscated without due process of law. We think that should come to an end, the sooner the better. We have lost our understanding about what a free society is, and we are determined to live as a materialistic society and claim that government will take care of us in anything and everything that we do. We think it's time, for instance, in foreign policy that Japan and Europe pays for their own national defense. Why should we sacrifice ourselves? You know, we spent hundreds of billions of dollars defending Europe over the last several decades. Ronald Reagan didn't even have flying rights when he decided to go to Libya. It's not even a good investment. It's morally wrong because we don't have any moral authority to involve ourselves in the internal affairs and use our CIA to plan murders and overthrows. Constitutionally, there is no authority for that type of activity. Where is it written in the Constitution that we should devise a central intelligence agency to go and trade weapons with the Ayatollah and terrorists and then fight secret wars? The Constitution doesn't defend it, and militarily it makes no sense whatsoever. There's no military advantage to our foreign policy because it is precisely the policy that encourages the communist movement in so many countries. Think about the Philippines and the Democrats and Republicans' support for Marcos, or whether it was for Batista in Cuba, or whether it was for Somoza in Nicaragua, or whether it was for the Shah in Iran. The people turn against us and turn toward radical forms of government. So it's more practical to accept the position of the founders of this country, saying that the purpose of foreign policy is to defend this country and to be neutral in the affairs of the world, rather than pretending that we're the policemen and that we know what's best for everybody else. Thomas Paine said, "Those who expect to reap the benefits of liberty must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it."
We as liberty. Why is it? What? You come back? You come back? You like me yet? And the girl say, "You gonna fuck me for true?" Shit like that, you know, it's shit. See, you go up north, white folks don't know what to do. You know, I'm saying, well, it's a different kind. You must be from Brazil somewhere.
Where's Polonius?
At supper.
At supper? Where?
Not where he eats, but where he is eaten. A certain convocation of politic worms are eating at him. Your worm is your only emperor for diet. We fat all creatures else to fat us, and we fat ourselves for maggots. Your fat king and your lean beggar is but variable service. Two dishes but to one table. That's the end.
A
man may fish with the worm that hath ate of a king, and eat of the fish that hath fed of that worm.
What dost thou mean by this?
Nothing but to show you how a king may go a progress through the guts of a beggar.
Where is Polonius?
In heaven. Send thither to see. If your messenger find him not there, seek him in the other place yourself. But if indeed you find him not within this month, you shall nose him as you go up the stairs into the lobby.
Go seek him there.
He will stay till you come.
Besides the reading of D.H. Lawrence, there was another element which had prepared me for Henry's gutter language, the Rabelaisian animalism of it. And this was my father's language when he was with intimate man friends or when he lost his temper. In Spain, it is a common thing for men to use obscene language at every occasion, but not in the presence of women. Men on every level of social or educational refinement. My mother deplored this, did all in her power to prevent our hearing or learning it, but admitted that it was a very Spanish trait.
Occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast no more. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fasten us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion, or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward. I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell. Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake. How stand I then, that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, while to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men that for a fantasy and trick of fame go to their graves like beds. Fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth.
This. It is no surprise Dickens was paid by the word.
A young woman who is about to die in a workhouse leaves a newborn baby with a bully named Bumble, who tags the toddler Oliver Twist. Oliver scarfs down some porridge for 9 years in an orphanage, and when he says, "Please, some more," Oliver's kicked out. So he hitches a ride to London, where he bumps into the artful Dodger, a young pickpocket who brings him to Fagin, the miserly master of a gang of juvenile delinquents who steal snuff boxes and hankies. Oliver then gets caught and rescued by Brownlow, who raises Oliver because Oliver just happens to look like some lady in a portrait. Then Nancy, who lives with Nasty Bill Sykes, who works for Fagin, who eats little boys for breakfast, robs a house with Oliver, and Oliver's shot and then nursed back to health by Mrs. Maley and her adopted daughter Rose, who just happen to be the people who live in the same house that Oliver tried to rob. Then Fagin and a guy with a scar named Monks track Oliver down, but Nancy gets cold feet and warns Rose, whose name she just happened to hear Monks mention to Fagin. So Rose takes Oliver back to Brownlow, but Sykes just happens to overhear Nancy's conversation with Rose, which incites Sykes to kill Nancy, but Brownlow finds Monks anyway, who just happens to be Oliver's half-brother, and tells Brownlow of his plan to keep all of their father's inheritance. But Oliver's mother just happened to have a little sister who just happened to be none other than Rose, who's Oliver's aunt, plus Brownlow just happened to be Oliver's father's best friend, which means absolutely nothing to Sykes and Fagin, who gets snuffed out anyway. But for Oliver, it means he just happens to be related to absolutely everyone else in the book, which just happens to be one big coincidence.
This skull has lain you with the earth 23 years.
Whose was it?
Orson mad fellows it was. Whose do you think it was?
Nay, I know not.
Pestilence on him for a mad rogue. I poured a flagon of Rhenish on my head once. This same skull, sir, was Yorick's skull, the king's jester.
This?
E'en that.
Let me see. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio. A fellow of infinite jest and most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times, and now, how abhorred in my imagination it is, my gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed I know not how oft. Where be your gibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment, that were wont to set the table on a roar? Not one now to mock your own grinning. Quite chop-fallen. Now get you to my lady's chamber, and tell her let her paint an inch thick. To this favor she must come. Make her laugh at that. Rashleigh, and praised be rashness for it, let us know our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do pall. And that should learn us there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will.
That is most certain.
Up from and in quit, we defy augury. There is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, it is not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man hath aught of what he leaves, what is to leave betimes? Let be.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have with us here today a very special guest. I'd like to bring him up and introduce him to you now. It's Martin Saw. He used to live in Pennsylvania. Now he's come to Vermont, and he has a lot to share with you all. Before we start the interview session, we'll all have a chance to call in on the show later on with your questions. Martin is famous for making smells. Sometimes we call them making smoke, but what else do we call them, Martin?
We call them farting away up your nose.
Well, where did you first hear the word fart? What was the first time you ever heard the word fart?
Fart away.
Well, there seems to be a kind of communication problem here. Are there different kinds of smells? Or what would you say about, do the farts and the smells, are they the same thing, would you say?
Well, there's things we call SBD, which stands for silent but deadly, and that's when you lay a fart sprinkle like that. Maybe with a question. Go ahead, Lucas.
Hello, Martin. I'm a wonderful admirer of yours. I think your farts are wonderful. Yes, wonderful. And would you mind describing to me what you mean in great detail when you say pooping up your nose?
Well, it started way back when the people took their tongues and shaped them a long time so they could have, and then they could curl their tongue, so there was a tube, and then the tube went all the way to the butt, and when the person went like, it would go up the air tube and into his nose. So what you see going out today is not the smoke, which people deceive you, but the fart that's coming out their nose of that tongue that's going deep, being an invisible tube in back, that tongue. You see the smoke coming out their nose. Sometimes you're in the house and it starts, you see the smoke pouring out people's nose and you're like, farting again, the little poopers.
Well, it's
thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. I was careful to write it all down.
We have another call here from Louette. You have a question? for Martin about farts.
Yes, I want to know when you fart, does it come out of your head or your butt?
Well, it comes out of your nose, as Lucas Saul just said, but, see, it comes out of your butt a lot of the time, but sometimes it comes out your brain, because, like, Freddy Krueger, he's not a scary person. He's just farting out his head. That's why you see his steaming head. He's just farting out of his head. That's a very good question. And this, a slang word for fart is actually poopy fart. And poopy fart is a slang word for fart. So that makes logic. And well, fart also has a slang word for the rat that pooped.
Tell me, in some situations, in social situations, where there may be grown-ups well-dressed, perhaps at an elegant dinner, and you feel the need to pass gas, as it were, what would you do under those situations? What would be your opinion of how we should behave at that time?
Well, I'd like to tell you a very good story. One time I was at a very nice, very formal, well, to me it was informal, dance. And see, everybody was dancing, and one time there was a slow song, and they had brought McDonald's food, and that McDonald's food, man, they pack it with air, so you really gotta, you know, a man has to do it when he's gotta do it. And you know, so one time I had my butt full of air, and man, if I let it out like air, it would have been going for top 5 minutes. So what you do, I went in the bathroom and I closed the door tight, and suddenly, so I said, and that was just at the right time, and I went like, except a lot louder, and boy, that bathroom blew up. I ended up getting sued, but I was so pissed at the judge, I just went like, the judge went out smelling his little brain out. Yes, that's a very good question.
We go to the phone lines. We have one other call coming in.
Martin, I've heard many of your farting routines, but I'm always interested in hearing another fart routine. Could you fart for us?
Well, okay, let me just get my air in. Okay, let me just test him out.
Gee, that must be like...
Okay, now let me go. Here's the fast part. Some people just go away with it. They go like...
Thank you. happiness doesn't depend on possessions. Happiness is a matter of attitude. That's to say, a happy man doesn't see the dark side of reality. His sense of life suppresses the gnawing woodworm of the consciousness of death. One forgets that instead of walking one's falling, it's as if one were drugged. So it's an offense to be asked after one's health. It's as if one asked, apple asks another, how are the worms which the insect bites give you? Or if the one blade of grass asks the other, how are you withering? How goes your esteemed decomposition? What would you think of that? Inquiries after one's health increase one's consciousness of dying, to which as a sick man I'm particularly exposed. I can't forget it. I have nothing that would drive it out of my mind. I lack an honest occupation. My occupation is really a form of decomposition. Every really active, purposeful life which completely fills a man has the force and splendor of a flame, but what do? I sit in the office. It's a foul-smelling factory of pain, in which there's no sense of happiness, and so I quite calmly lie to those who inquire after my health instead of turning away like a condemned man, which is in fact what I am. The war, the revolution in Russia, and the misery of the whole world seem to me like a flood of evil. It's an inundation. The war has opened the floodgates of chaos. The buttresses of human existence are collapsing. Historical development is no longer determined by the individual, but by the masses. We're shoved and rushed and swept away. We're the victims of history. Simply to say something is not enough. One must live it, and for this language is an essential intermediary. Something living, a medium. Yet language also must not be used as a means, but must be experienced, suffered. Language is an eternal mistress. All my scribbling doesn't deserve a leather binding. It's only my own personal specter of horror. It oughtn't to be printed at all. It ought to be burned and destroyed. It's without meaning. One must be silent if one can't give any help. No one, through his own lack of hope, should make the condition of others worse. For that reason, all my scribbling is to be destroyed. I'm no light. I have merely lost my way among my own thorns. I'm a dead end. As a matter of fact, armies have one slogan only. Forward on behalf of all those who sit behind us at the cash desks and writing tables. For modern armies, the true ideals of humanity do not lie ahead as an objective, but in the rear, where everything human has been betrayed. Are you familiar with Chaplin? Only slightly, Kafkaesque. I've seen one or two of his grotesques. That's a very energetic, work-obsessed man. There burns in his eyes the flame of despair at the unchangeable condition of the oppressed. Yet he does not capitulate to it. Like every genuine comedian, he has the bite of a beast of prey, and he uses it to attack the world. He does it in his own unique way. Despite the white face and the black eyebrows, he's not a sentimental Pierrot, nor is he a snarling critic. Chaplin's a technician. He's the man of the machine world, in which most of his fellow men no longer command the requisite emotional and mental equipment to make the life allotted to them really their own. They don't have the imagination. As a dental technician makes false teeth, so he manufactures aids to the imagination. That's what his films are. That's what films in general are. Of course, the cinema is a marvelous toy. I cannot bear it, though. Perhaps because I'm too optical by nature. The cinema disturbs one's vision. The speed of the movements, the rapid changes of the images force men to look continually from one to another. Sight doesn't master the pictures. It's the pictures that master the sight. They flood one's consciousness. The cinema involves putting the eye into uniform, when before it was naked. Many men now are just recovering their youth for the first time. For the first time they're passing through the cowboy and Indian stage. Naturally, not so that they scamper along the paths of the municipal park armed with bows and arrows. No, they sit in the cinema and watch adventure films. That's all it is. The darkened cinema is the magic lantern of their wasted youth. I'm against virtuosity. The virtuoso rises above his subject because of his juggler facility. But can a poet be superior to his subject? No, he's held captive by the world he has experienced and portrayed, as God is by his own creation. To liberate himself from it, he places it outside himself. That's not an act of virtuosity, it's a birth. An addition to life, like all births. Have you ever heard a woman say that she is a virtuoso in childbearing? Sin is turning away from one's own vocation. Misunderstanding, impatience, and sloth, that's sin. The poet has the task of leading the isolated and mortal into eternal life, the accidental into conformity to law.